Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September 19th. Today's Elder Hostel session in geology is entitled The Laws of Geology, Disregard Them at Your Peril, presented by Don Coberly. Let's listen in.
There were a couple of questions that were raised either in session or just after session. Agate. Someone was asking about agate.
Me too.
Agate is quartz, or a form of quartz, the same stuff that makes up quartz. And usually where it's found is in a vug, V-U-G, or a cavity in some other kind of rock, either limestone or a volcanic rock. There is a vug is like an open space. It's a geologic term for an open space. And water percolates through the rock and forms around some sort of seed crystal, and then continuously coats that crystal until it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And depending on the precise form of that silica and what it might have picked up on the way, that's where you get the play of colors or the various how it sort of changes from band to band almost. Okay, that's an agate. Someone asked about a geode. A geode, from what I can tell, is a bigger version of an agate. It has some of that same quartz on the outside, but inside it may have quartz or it may have some other kind of calcite crystal. And I can't tell you. This is where geologists differ from doctors. Geologists will tell you they don't know. I can't tell you precisely all of the formation of a geode. But what I've read is there's that same sort of quartz stuff on the outside, but I don't know how you get the crystals inside and then have this outer shell on it. And another thing that characterizes a geode is they're bigger.
All the geodes I have observed in museum specimens and so on are essentially an egg or round-shaped independent stone with a different characteristic interior.
Right.
What accounts for that rounded shape? They must be washed by erosion or wave action or something for millennia?
Either that or when they get to a certain point, then it's additional deposition on the outside of it. So I don't know whether it's a depositional thing or whether it's an erosional thing. I can't tell you. Don't know that.
Let's go back to agate. Across the lake from us, we have what we call Agate Bay.
Yes.
You can go and pick up agates all along the lake shore.
Uh-huh.
How does that happen, that they're all there?
Well, then it's some sort of concentrating mechanism. When you pan for gold, how do you pan for gold? You get all this mud and stuff in your gold pan and you sluice water through it and you shake it real gently and the heaviest stuff settles to the bottom, which is the gold, and by the time you get done with the pan, that's all that you've got left. So there has to be some mechanism. First off, if it's a beach, that agate, when it was originally deposited, it may have been deposited with a bunch of other stuff. I said it gets found in the bugs in the rock.
Yeah,
well, that outer rock has to get eroded away. Agate being made of silica, that's very, very, very resistant stuff. So the same way that the rock tumbler, if we take something and put it in a rock tumbler, you can get rid of some of the rock and leave some of it behind. And so I think that would be...
So the ice age, it came down and carved the valley that I lived in.
And that may have carried a bunch of rock down, a bunch of different stuff down, and then it gets onto the beach, and the beach pounds it every day, and the less resistant stuff gets winnowed away. The day the glacier retreated, you wouldn't have been able to go just pick up agates. It would have been there with everything.
Yeah. Okay.
My dad told me that agates all come from pregnant rocks.
In geology, one of the basic concepts is called multiple working hypotheses. You come up with all of the different ways that something might happen, and then you sort of rank those as to what's more likely or what's less likely. So that one would be one of our multiple working hypotheses. We might move away from it fairly quickly. Okay, where we quit yesterday was talking about rocks. I want to finish up the metamorphic rocks in about 5 minutes and then get on to what we're going to talk about today. Metamorphic rocks, again, the idea of metamorphosis, some sort of change. The conditions that we care about that change at the Earth's surface are pressure and temperature. And I'm not talking about temperature, whether it's 10 degrees or 100 degrees outside. That doesn't really matter very much to a rock. But as the rock gets buried deeper and deeper and deeper, the geothermal gradient, if you go down in a mine, it's warmer down in the mine than it is up here. Right? If you go down 1,000 feet, you pick up like 2 degrees, something like that. Well, go down 5,000 feet and you picked up 10 degrees. Keep something a little bit warmer for a million years and you can change it. The first sort of level of metamorphosis that we think of is just simply adding weight and temperature. And the best example of that would be to take shale, which I think most people know about, the dark mud rock, and squish it. That's a technical term. And you make slate. And we mine slate to make pool tabletops out of. And I forgot to bring a piece of shale down from the mine museum with me, but one of the things you can do is you can take a piece of shale and a piece of slate, and you'll notice that the slate's heavier, it's denser. It's shale that's just been compressed into a smaller package. So here's a piece of shale coming one way, and here's a big piece of shale coming the other.
This is slate.
Slate.
This is what they used to use for blackboards way back when.
Just after they got done writing on the backs of their shovels, the next generation was writing on slate blackboards.
Okay.
Go ahead.
When writing, we came upon a hill and it had big old pieces, you know, like this big, and they'd slide against each other. Now, which one would that be? I thought it was shale.
Well, it could be either one. Shale is very similar because it's mud, it's oceanic mud that has dropped, or mud coming off the continents, so it's very fine grain and it goes into the sheets, right? So that could be either one. If you take those sheets of shale and you squash them really hard, put a bunch of weight on top of them, now you get slate. So it's the same stuff, it's the same rock, it's just one is more compressed than the other. It's been metamorphosed. Okay? Go ahead.
Were you saying that difference, if you go down 5,000 feet, that difference of 10 degrees over a long period of time is significant? Or you have to go a lot deeper?
It is over a million years. If you keep that rock at that a little bit elevated temperature for a really, really long time, and at the same time, you're squashing it with 5,000 feet of more rock on top of it, those two things in conjunction are what will metamorphose the rock, make it denser. With shale and slate, what we notice is there's nothing in there that has sort of ruined the original orientation. Mm-hmm. It's still really flatlined. If you would push on it at the same time, you would start to buckle the slate or the shale a little bit. And if you push on it very gently over a million years and it's a little bit heated, it will develop what is called schistosity, and the rock will be a schist, the most carefully pronounced thing in all of geology. And you'll see little wrinkles develop. If you would push on that, the same way, we have a perfectly flat pad of paper, and we start pushing on it very gently over a long period of time, we can start to develop little wrinkles in it. That's
what's happening here.
That's what's happening with this next rock I'm passing around. And that little waviness or crenellation is another term. That's called schistosity, and the rock is called a schist. That's a German term for, I forget what.
A rock that has little waves in it.
Exactly.
So when you see the waves, is that because the rock was this way when the pressure came, or sideways?
That's an excellent point. If all you have is weight sitting on top, you won't generate that. All you'll do is turn your shale into slate. That indicates some pressure from another direction. And if we can find that rock in place out in the world, which means it's connected to the rest of the world, not like we have it in our hands right now, we can use the orientation, the direction of that crenulation to tell us when those bumps form perpendicular to the direction of the pushing. So we know what direction the bumps are. We say, okay, this direction then has to be the direction of the pushing. And we also know it's pushing. If you pull on something, you don't get those bumps. If I pull on this pad of paper, I don't get wrinkles in it. I've got to push on it to get the wrinkles. So that's an excellent point. We see those, and we see those in the field. We would take a measurement of them and write them in our notebook. And then when we got back later on that evening and we were having a beer, we would talk it over. So
to go back to the simulation you used yesterday of one geologist going out into the field to gather samples and the other one going to the stream bed to gather samples, would you ever get useful information about that particular issue of pressure in the stream bed?
Absolutely not. Another great point. That's one of the advantages that Jamie would have from his 3 weeks of being beaten to death that I wouldn't have. If he can find those rocks in place out in the field, that's an added value that he has. Yep, absolutely. I have one. Here is another version, and I think this metamorphic rock that I'm passing around now seems to me kind of halfway between those two that I've shown you so far. It's not completely flat like a slate would be, and there's just the starting hints of the schistosity that we can see. And so if we were thinking about this, we'd think, okay, slate, no additional outside pressure, schist, a fair amount of outside pressure. There's another term that you might, another rock type called gneiss, another German term, G-N-E-I-S-S, which is even more metamorphosed. And in that case, what's happened is the minerals actually segregate into bands. That if you press on it and heat it up long enough and hard enough, the minerals will rearrange into bands. And so there's a term, banded gneiss, that you might have heard. That's the next step in the metamorphic sort of cycle from little metamorphism to a lot of metamorphism. And then there is the final stage of metamorphism, which is remelting. And now we're back into the rock cycle. Now it's an igneous rock. Go ahead, please.
Are these this one is slate?
That's slate. And the white that is there that happened after the slate was formed. There was some fracture in the slate, and some mineral came in and filled in later on. When you see banded gneiss, you'll see if you have a big hunk of it, there will be anywhere from, an inch to many inch thick bands that are parallel to one another. Again, if you see those bands, that's the direction of the pressure that has caused the minerals to segregate and reorient. So there is this continuum from slate to schist to gneiss to remelted. And the point of that third rock that I'm passing around is, where does it fall on that continuum? And we can say, not very much metamorphosed, a lot, or somewhat metamorphosed, a lot metamorphosed. Okay? Go ahead.
So you can metamorphose the clay stone, which is shale.
Yep.
But I don't hear you talking about metamorphosing like sandstone for bigger particles.
Precisely the same thing happens if you metamorphose a sandstone. If you metamorphose that jar of sand that I passed around yesterday, you get a thing called quartzite, which is just the bloody hardest stuff on the planet because it's quartz to start with, which is really stout. and then you squish it and densify it even more. If you, you can metamorphose limestone, we call that marble, and we cut it up and we put it on buildings. So you can metamorphose all different, again, that rock cycle of igneous, metamorphic, and sedimentary. You can metamorphose sediment, so you can metamorphose those clastic rocks, claystone or sandstone, or you can metamorphose chemical rocks like limestone and make it into marble. You can metamorphose igneous rocks, and that they're maybe on Friday when we're taking the mine site hike, we'll go take a look at a rock that I think is a piece of metamorphosed granite. And then at the end of the, you know, you take it out to its nth degree and you remelt those rocks. You can remelt that quartzite after a long period of time, and now it goes into the melt and comes out as an igneous rock the next time around. Go ahead.
The bands could be from something else. Couldn't they be from something that happened during that when that rock was exposed, like volcanic layers or... maybe a volcano erupted and
or water
laid down
a
layer.
Well, those would be the characteristics of the original rock, the original sedimentary rock, get kept for some period in the metamorphic process. So that's a possibility. And then again, as you go through this whole range of little metamorphism to a lot of metamorphism, those things would get lost. Those get lost as that schist stays under pressure and temperature, and now the minerals reorient into the bands, and now you lose those sort of leaves.
So what causes that reorientation in the bands?
What the reason the rock reorients is that arrangement is a thermodynamically preferred orientation. It's lower energy on the thermodynamic scale for like minerals to be next to like minerals.
Okay. And so it's sort of like a chromatography or something where elements separate out?
Right.
Okay.
Right. So that it's not nearly as it's a whole other sort of level of complexity.
Yeah.
Than simply the pushing on the rock and crenulating it or making it schistose. That's the verb for pushing on something.
Are diamonds at the end of the line?
Diamonds are unique in that they are carbon, pure carbon, but carbon that was formed under tremendous pressure and temperature and then gotten to the surface very rapidly. That's the key thing about why diamonds are so rare. There's diamonds all over the place. They just happen to be 3 miles deep, or 4 miles or 5 miles deep, and it's getting them to the surface without having to go to South Africa and mining them. All the other diamonds that we find loose on the surface have been brought through a very specific and obscure sort of method, which is why there aren't a lot of diamonds around. It's a volcanic type of eruption that is like a pinprick, where the velocity of the material coming up is just huge. It's trying to push all the toothpaste out of a pinprick in the tube. It shoots out, and so you take this stuff that was at its sort of standard conditions way down deep of high pressure and temperature, and boom, get it to the surface. You get it, the flow is hundreds of miles an hour, so you can get it to the surface very rapidly, but it's really rare, which is why we don't make a lot of diamonds at the surface. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, we're going to finish by probably about Thanksgiving, I'm thinking.
Sorry.
Today, I'll just keep talking about what you guys want to talk about. As long as it's not seniors and sex, because
are horses or bulls?
I had to leave. I'm sorry. We all have our limits.
That was loss of control. control.
And you know, anytime my sessions get to be, you know, that worrying to you, you can leave mine. We've been through a couple of pictures in your handouts, and then there is a sheet of text that says, for a moment, imagine that your task is to figure out the geology of an unknown area. How would you do this? If I were doing this, the first thing I would do would be get a U.S. Geological Survey topo map of the area. Here's the one for Holden Village. It shows the village right here, so that as we go out on our hike, we could locate ourselves. In thinking about it, I assume that in geology classes that are being taught in university right now, everybody's got a portable GPS on them, and they just locate themselves on point by point, and then they go download it to the computer and overlay it on top of here. It may not be the case, but that would seem like a really good technical solution to me. And in our case, we're just going to walk along, and we're going to figure out where we are on the map. The second thing I would do would be hike around, look at rocks, put rock outcrops on the map, and write notes in my field book. Now, a rock outcrop, we'll look at those tomorrow. That's the places where we see a big mass of rock that we think is attached to the rest of the world. It's stable, and it's going to be there next week when we come back, or next year when we come back to fight with our thesis advisor on what the rock really means. If we find a rock out here in the middle of the road, we don't really care about that rock so much because somebody's going to kick it into the gutter, and when we come back next year, we won't find it. So one of the questions we will talk about tomorrow on the hike is this rock mass attached to the world or not? And if it's not, that's like me finding the rock in the stream. It has some value to us. We know it's there. We know what the rock type is. But if there's anything about any sort of orientation or any other specific data, we can't really use that rock for that additional data. So that's a rock outcrop, is this gob of rock or this mass of rock that you think is still going to be there next year. Figure out the relationship in space of the rock units to one another. This is what we're going to talk about today and the ways that we can do that. So let's hold that for just a second. Number four is finish our geologic map. Here's a geologic map of the Holden area. And what it is that topo map with various rock units superimposed on top of it and where we think they are. And we can either go find them because we can go put our hand on them, or we think they go underneath the creek and come on the other side, so we dash some lines under the creek. We can't drill down and find them, but we believe them to be there because we see them on the other side. And now, next time somebody comes up here, they say, well, let's go get that Elder Hostel class geologic map so that we, when we go take our hike up the valley, we know what we're hiking on.
When you use the word rock in that sense, are you really meaning mineral, or are you meaning something solid that's attached to the earth? Or, I mean, because, or is this rock the overriding term for structure in the environment?
In this case, when I talk about rock, when I talk about rock outcrops, that's the stuff that's stuck to the rest of the world, and that's what we can find. And so whether that's a limestone or a sandstone, that's the generic. Number five, describe the geologic history of the area. Once we have the geologic map, again, at night, sitting around the table with our beer, we start saying, well, how did those units get the way they are? Let's tell a story about, from as far back as we can tell, what's the oldest rock unit we see around here? It's 200 million years ago. Okay, how do we find it now? Well, we find it tipped up on its end. Well, we have to come up with some idea as how it got tipped up on its end. We tell the geologic story, and that's written on the side, or it's written in the pamphlet that goes along with this map. And then the last thing you do is you get your degree, you get paid if you're a consulting geologist, or you open your mind, whatever the rationale was for why you're doing geology in the first place. And if you have a big piece of property, and you find up on one little corner of it, oh, here's something that might be gold. That's interesting. I wonder, where is that someplace else on my property? You might go through the same set of processes. You would start up in the corner and you would look at the geology there, and you'd see if you could figure it out a little bit, and then you might say, okay, well, if it's up here, and it kind of dips this way, it kind of goes down that way, huh, right under there, under the corner of the house, if I drill down to 150 feet, I might run into it.
Right.
Okay. We need those, what the analogy that came to me a little bit ago was, if rocks are sort of the words of the language of geology, what we're going to talk about now are the rules of grammar. How do you hook those rocks together to make stories? How do you hook those words together to make an actual sentence out of it? If I find a rock over here and I find the same kind of rock over here, how can I make sense of where they are in relationship to each other in space? And so what I call those are the laws of geology, and that's your next page. I've just gone on to the page called The Laws of Geology. It's in color.
John, could you go back and try and repeat those last two sentences? If rocks are the words of the world, of geology?
If rocks are the words of geology.
Of geology.
Then the laws of geology are the rules of grammar.
The laws of geology are the rules
of grammar.
Grammar. Thanks.
Sure. If anybody, after we get done with this session, if anybody has a better analogy or a different analogy, I'd be glad to hear it. It's the way that we make sense out of, can we connect up the way we see rocks in space? Can we make sense out of it? And the way I've done this, the laws or the principles are written in black. It's black and white. We'll not have any discussion about it. The second part that's written in red is sort of the, let's take this pedantic educational talk and make it more casual. So the principle of uniformitarianism. Everybody goes, what the heck is that? It says the present is the key to the past. Let's hold on to that for just a second. The third sort of layer that I have here is the stuff in blue, which is sort of an aside that should help us think through what the law is and why there is some utility to it. So, first thing we're going to do is talk about the principle of uniformitarianism. And the first of your slides shows this idea, or the next handout that you have, which I have a slide of up here on the overhead, shows the present. This is a mud pot at Yosemite or Yellowstone or someplace like that, where the mud's been heated and it's bubbling up. This is a fossilized version of something that's 3.6 billion years old, or something. I forget precisely what the date is. 3.5 billion years ago. They are virtually identical to modern examples from volcanic region of Bolivia. Yellowstone, Bolivia is what I meant to say. So the point is, those processes that we see today, or recently, Mount St. Helens blowing up in 1980, or the Hawaiian volcanoes blowing or erupting the way they do today, we think that that's the way things have happened over the great expanse of geologic history. So we can use the Hawaiian volcanoes that we see today and say, oh, okay, well, if we go someplace else in the rock record and we find some basalt, which is the rock that gets spewed out by the volcano, we find that someplace else, oh, we think we got an idea as to what kind of volcano erupted that. We don't have to come up with new rules where 2 billion years ago rain fell up or water flowed uphill. It does kind of, it used to do back then what it's doing today. Okay? Present is the key to the past. A caveat to that is, I think for the first little portion of Earth's history, when the Earth was predominantly molten, there were probably a different set of rules. There wasn't a lot of solid rock to stand on, for one thing. But we can still go back to 3.5 billion years ago and find stuff like this. So for at least the last 3.5 billion years, the rules have held. So that's plenty long term, right? The second thing, the law of original horizontality. Somebody obviously had to come up with that to get like a master's thesis. Or maybe it was just back in the olden days, things had to sound more important. The point of that is rocks get laid down flat. Now in reality, it's most rocks get laid down mostly flat. But we're going to stay simple for right now. Most rocks, 70% of the rocks that we know that we see at the surface are sedimentary rocks. How do sediments form? Ones out in the ocean, either sand or clay gets shot off the edges of the continents and then gets entrained into the water and settles very slowly. When those particles fall, they fall into a layer, and those layers are generally flat or almost flat. Right? Make sense? We don't find one particle stacking on top of another, 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 another. You find that as a stalactite or a stalagmite in a cave, but the vast majority of rocks get laid down flat or nearly so. The Columbia River basalts, but if you go through Oregon, when you drive up, that stuff bubbled up to the surface and flowed out tens of miles anyway, in layers that were, you can see them as you're driving along, 100 feet thick. So those things got laid down essentially flat. Now they may have draped over things every now and again, you'll see that, but the vast majority of rocks get laid down flat. Even on the really steep volcanoes, some stuff gets laid down at a little more of a degree, a little more of an angle, but then the water comes along and washes it and makes it into a sediment and now deposits it as flat rock again. Flat rocks get laid down flat. Someone at an elder hostel session might ask, well, who cares? The point there, and it's written in the blue here, is that if you see rocks that are not flat, you have to come up with some reason, some motion, some action to get them to be not flat. And that there's a hint and gentle reminder and an example of that here in this set of rocks. This is from near Banff in Canada. And these are, you will have to trust me, this piece of slate right here, it's in here somewhere. It's like this one, or maybe it's just off the edge of the photo. That's where this is from. So knowing that and believing me, we will say that these are sedimentary rocks. What do we know about sedimentary rocks? Based on the law of original horizontality. They were laid down flat. Are they flat now? No. Does it make sense in our multiple working hypotheses to say that let's take one bed right here, this one? Well, you know, it could be that a piece fell right here, and then the next day one fell right here, and the next day one fell right here, but it didn't fall over here, and so this thing sort of built up day by day over a million years in that angle. That doesn't make any sense. It's more likely that these things were laid down flat and then somehow tipped up on end. Okay? So that's the point. The point of the law of original horizontality is not that it's so valuable in its own right. It's when you see stuff that isn't flat anymore, you have to come up with a reason for it. That's not the way these rocks didn't get laid down like this. Okay?
I assume that's a roadbed or something in the bottom there. But don't we see banding in two 90-degree planes there? I mean, or is that just the cut surfaces, all the white-gray alternating in the angled band? Was that cut?
This is a flat face. Right here.
Uh-huh.
Oh, this secondary thing?
Yeah, right.
Let me ponder that. And I'll come up with a really harebrained story tomorrow. Unless it comes to me even faster than that. It could be because that's how it was. There might be planes of weakness so that as they were gouging this out with their D9, or whatever they call that up in Canada, there's got to be a conversion rate from caterpillar in the... That's a joke. Do you need me to explain this? Caterpillar tractors come in different numbers. D1, and that's a shovel. D2 is kind of a small thing. D9 is a really... Never mind. Can we have a break? We have 4 minutes to go before break. But you can leave anytime you want, of course.
Could you see, could you explain what you're describing that is also going
in? Oh, there is a set of, it would be nice to have a pointer.
There is a pointer behind the piano.
Ah, I got it. It's a pool cue.
See it?
No. I think it's chiseled by.
Oh, break your neck.
Chiseled
by
the
D9. Yeah, it was a D9 or something. It's a lot. Lost man's
tracker, but. Yeah. It looks like it was just
what Rick was pointing out was here are these sort of secondary linear features that sort of run through the rock. Does everybody see those?
Yeah.
Now that Rick's pointed them out to me and
thank you, Rick.
And I think the point is a good one that sort of in the world in general, things are pretty random. So if we see things oriented a certain way, again, we should come up with some reason why they would be that way. So I'm going to think about that. And
how was that picture taken? I'm still trying to figure that out.
How was it taken?
Yeah. What is it, a small section of something or a large section? Is it by a road? Is it a highway cut? What the heck is it?
I was standing right about here. I was actually standing on the other side of the Canadian Highway, Trans-Canada Highway, looking across the road, and this is the road cut on the back side of the road. So it goes uphill from there, and they cut all this off so that they could put the highway through.
What's that at the top, the border at the top?
That's the border of the slide.
All right, now you have one at the bottom.
Oh, jeez. That's the road down there. Anyway, so
when you see it on this, it almost, look, rather than banding, it looks like the light has hit a different angle on projections out from the rock.
Sure.
So
well,
it doesn't really look, at least on here, it looks more like it's just an artifact from the photograph of the light than where it hit.
Okay.
I guess we're getting into our watercolor
side. Excellent. I'm glad that we're being holistic.
All
right, the next law that we're going to talk about in the next minute and 20 seconds we'll get started on is called the law of superposition, which says that the oldest stuff is on the bottom. If you think about building a layer cake, one way to build a layer cake is to have one layer on the bottom and then put another layer on top and then another layer on top and another layer on top. Another way to do it would be to put a layer on the bottom and then put some toothpicks on it and then put a layer on it next and then somehow later on jam another layer in where the toothpicks were.
Yeah, sure.
And you can make a cake that way, yeah. But it would be, right?
It's pretty dumb.
Would be pretty dumb.
This is intelligent design, right?
This is. this is.
I think we've got the one beer hypothesis.
This is a geology
hypothesis. This is.
One beer hypothesis.
This is.
This is a beer geology.
Semi-intelligent geology. So the concept to come out of this with is if we see a layer of rocks, a set of layers, the oldest rock should be on the bottom, right? So let's take a break right now.
Okay.
And when we come back, we'll talk about, here's the idea to think about while you're on your break is, are these the oldest rocks down here? Or are these the oldest rocks up here? For 10 minutes.
10 minutes.
I got a bunch of.
I
Yeah, you better take care of my investment there.
How true, how true.
You'd think with as much invested in her as I got, I'd be nicer to her.
I'm glad he was listening.
Reform that stuff?
Every one of those rocks.
It must have been foremost.
If you look at them, they all look like they could have, you know, like,
but I mean, all of them, the slimmer part of it, little institution.
Yeah. Not exactly line shoe, but it's like they just slice them off. Every small one of we like each other.
That's the underlying, all of those would have come from those blood rocks that developed that. Well, rocks is just squeezed up mud. It's all stout mud.
But the rocks are there. Of course, that was
on the
walk. You say thousands upon thousands of years.
10 mile fall.
It's all. That's where it is.
Yep.
I knocked on my own ribbon through it. And it's almost like a picture of it.
Being too specific about what came shown on the screen, something on the top, you can visualize.
I don't like it.
I love that.
This is the bottom of it.
And I've never done this before, so I'm really. No, but you're going to going up to the line.
Grandnieces.
And that's.
And this.
Mine is not.
Terror, which you use about a year since.
Way before you get to the line, if you turn off the line.
And she's calm now, it's unbelievable.
That's only says it's a mile.
It did.
We just go to see.
I know, I brought four bags in and I ran them Saturday night.
Oh, you did?
Well, I looked at them, they were all. I haven't had a chance, and that's why I wanted to do something. Because I know where this.
There's that long.
You know where my job time is.
How about this? Is that excavator still here?
We're on.
Jim wants to go hiking.
So you report out.
Everybody might know.
Has anybody got any geology questions that they want answered now that we can take care of while others are filtering back in? Excellent. Glad to hear it.
You've done such a good job.
Yeah. There are a lot of bizarre questions.
Don't look behind the curtain. Don't pay any attention to that man behind the curtain. There we go. Well, we could get started. Before we move on to that question I left you with, here is a quiz on the law of superposition. Again, in my general analogy mode, I see there being no difference between burning candles on my table in Portland and thinking about lava flows from Hawaiian volcanoes. The question is, in what order were the three candles burned to create this artistic whatever it is?
Black, yellow, red.
Black, yellow, red. With black being the first, yellow being the middlest, and red being the last. Using all of the evidence we have at hand, first off, red being last, I think I like that because part of the candle's still there. And whatever rationale was being used to come up with this, we see places where there is red that flows on top of black. Here we can see the relationship of black to yellow, right? Because here's a little pod of yellow sitting on top of the black. So we know we have yellow before black, or yellow after black, excuse me. And where do we have right here? We have some red, I think, flowing on top of the yellow. And here we have these little tendrils of red flowing across both black, and I think there's some yellow in there as well. So I agree that red was the last candle burned, yellow was the one that was burned in the middle, and black was the first one that was burned.
We can also comment about the prevailing wind.
Or the tilt of the table, perhaps. Okay, that's a really interesting idea, Don, that fits for burning candles. So what? Well, rather than these being red, yellow, and black, let's think about if we're in the Hawaiian Islands and we're tracing volcanic flows. We're not going to see black, red, and yellow volcanic flows, but we might find some characteristic of a flow, whether it has more bubbles in it that we can trace, or whether it may be more red than the others because it had more iron in it and that iron has rusted. So we could use that same sort of method of thinking, rationale, for tracing these various distances, and we could find to be sure, oh yeah, here's our condition right near the vent of the volcano.
let's see if that holds at some distance, and it better. Law of superposition, oldest stuff is on the bottom. That's the first candle that got burned. Yellow in the middle, red, the most recent, is on top. Okay. To go back to the question that I left you with, is that the same orientation as the moon? How about that? Okay. Are these the oldest rocks down here, or are these the oldest rocks up here? How many people say these are the oldest rocks down here? How many people say these are the oldest rocks up here?
I don't like being wrong.
How many people say...
Oh, choice.
Who cares? How many people say who cares? I have two. Both on the staff.
How would you tell? No, really.
Sorry.
That is exactly the right question. If... For example, these rocks were originally laid down flat, with the oldest being this hand right here and the youngest being this hand right here, and they were tipped up like this, then these are the old rocks and these are the young rocks, right?
Yes.
What happened if instead the rocks were like this and were tipped up over 90 degrees to 135 degrees to where we see them now? Now these would be the older rocks, and these would be the younger rocks.
Those would be the scrunch.
So the answer is it depends. That idea of rocks being overturned, oh, come on, Don, that's crazy. You can't overturn rocks. Here, you have these. What happens when you start pushing on this pile of rocks? And the first thing that happens is you get a big bow. But if you continue to push even harder and farther, now you can fold these rocks over on top of themselves. And now we get a situation where this is the oldest rock on the bottom of the pile. But if we erode all this off, if we would cut this paper off right here, here we would see the oldest rock on the top of the pile. Okay, fine, well enough. Where on earth does that happen?
A lot.
How about Copper Peak? How about right here at Holden Village? How about the ore body that the Holden mine was mined out of sits like this in space, and the oldest rocks are on the top. Those rocks that were laid down, so here's old right hand, have been pushed as everything got sort of jammed onto the west coast of the United States, which is the geologic history. This is like a 22-car pileup, and through that compression, things got pushed not only to 90 degrees, but got tipped over. So in that case, the oldest rocks are on the top. So the question is, how do we know? How can we tell? And the next sheet in your handout are a number of different things called criteria for determining top and bottoms of beds. Again, we go back to the idea that the most common rock type that we're going to find is sedimentary rocks. Those are beds. How can we figure out which is the top of the bed, and how can we figure out which is the bottom of the bed? One thing that we can do is the first thing that they talk about is tracing of beds, or recognition of a known normal sequence. That's things the way they're supposed to be. If we find at our volcano, in our candle melting picture, that we have the order, and we trace those out to someplace distance, and now the order is goofed up, and it's opposite of the way we thought it was, well, that part of the world has been overturned. We've got it established in one location. If we find it some different someplace else, we've got to come up with the reason for that. The second thing is, if we see scouring or channeling, and you have a color picture in your handouts. Here is a scour.
Pretty sky.
This is in Florida. It's a beautiful, beautiful sky.
Yeah.
This is what used to be a coral reef that I assume got brought up above the ground surface and then was eroded by a stream and then that filled in. So my suggestion would be that this sequence that we see is right side up. That's the way we talk about it, either it being right side up or upside down. The rocks here at Holden are upside down. They're overturned. One way to think about this, one way to give you an idea, let's go back to our multiple working hypotheses, is does it make more sense? Is it possible that this is, we can, let's forget the sky for right now. If we saw this in a road cut, does this make more sense to us to suggest that the whole bloody thing's been overturned? I don't think the environment really likes seeing these little lumps sticking out in the world, but the environment, what erosion is trying to do is wear the entire surface flat. So if we can't come up with a good reason for this lump being here, to me it makes more sense.
It's a cavity, not a lump in that projection.
Sorry?
It's a cavity, not a lump in this projection.
Well, in this, in my scenario, I'm talking about this lump being here first and then this stuff being deposited on top of it. Yours is a third hypothesis, which is this is right side up, but this was a cavity that was formed in this whatever it happens to be. That's another thing we have to consider. Again, if you're faced in the geologic world with multiple working hypotheses, let's look at one, let's see which makes more sense. And again, turn this figure upside down. And do we very often see out in the world these little lumps? And I think we don't.
Well, they're like Indian mounds.
That's true. They're in part of glacial areas, the northeast, the Monadnocks up in northern New York State. There are places where you'll see things that are just like this. But again, that's the exception to the rule. If we see a conglomerate, which one of the rocks we talked about yesterday, with the agglomeration of all different kinds of stuff, here is an older set of rocks down at the bottom, but then a big flood came in and ripped up some of the surface and incorporated those pebbles into the overlying and younger sedimentary rock. The sediment, this stuff has some of the older stuff in it. Can it work the other way? Can we somehow have what? How would that work out? Is it possible that, let's turn this upside down and say, how do we get this younger stuff incorporated into the older rock unit? You can't very well do that. How can, I'll have to think of a good analogy for that, but in this case, we have older rock here that has some of the younger rock in it. That doesn't make any sense. So there are in this, another one of these ideas that we have that we can look at is called graded bedding. What we'll find, if there's a flood, as the crest of the flood passes, that's the most energetic water, can carry the biggest particles. As the flood starts to dissipate, those biggest particles fall out. As the flood continues to dissipate, smaller, the next size falls out, and the next size falls out, and the next size falls out, and when the whole flood crest has passed, now the smallest stuff falls out. So you'll find big particles with somewhat smaller, until you get to very fine grain particles. This is the right side up way. This is the way it was deposited. So if we're out in the world and we see it the other way around, we think, huh, this stuff might be overturned. We have to keep that as an idea. And the next color picture that you have is precisely that scenario where if you take this sort of gray-yellow boundary to be the top of the next sequence, here you have fairly coarse, predominantly coarse material at the bottom, and as you move upward in space, you get into generally finer grain stuff. It's not perfect in this case because this is real world rather than a picture book. But as you go up higher to that next contact point, where's my pointer? Everything between kind of this boundary and this one gets progressively finer as you go up. So we would guess that this sequence is in place.
Is this all pumice?
In fact, this is all pumice in this picture. This is from Mount St. Helens. That's very good. There are more, and this is from an AGI data sheet, which is just a little notebook that you could carry with you so that if we were going into the field, we would have all these sort of cheat sheets and hint cards with us. So if we were going along and we would see something, we'd go, is this right side up or upside down? Well, let's go look at our cheat sheets and make sure we cover all the bases. And we might get to a point where we'd say, geez, we still don't know. We've looked at all of these. And so the answer to the question that you ask, how do we know? And how do we know in that road cut in at Banff? There really isn't enough there for me to know based on the evidence at hand. There's no scours in here that we can tell at. There's no graded bedding that I can tell from having looked at this a little bit. There's none of those. There are no mud cracks like we saw at the top of that second cart. No ripple marks, anything like that. There's nothing in here to tell us. And so when we're doing this geology in the field, we just have to say, question mark, assumed right side up, maybe overturned, question mark, move on. And at the end of the day, when we're all sitting around having beer with all our other cohort geologists, we would say, well, did somebody see something that I missed that helps us tell that? Now, knowing, since this is an area that's been mapped a lot, in fact, all of this stuff has been overturned. This is the old stuff down here. But we can't tell that from the evidence that we have in the moment. I'm going to skip over the law of inclusions right now because it won't come into play in what we have to deal with tomorrow for the hike. And I'll move on to the law of cross-cutting relationships. And I have another example, like from yesterday, except I'm not going to throw powdered sugar on myself. I'm going to do something different to help explain the law of cross-cutting relationships. Can everybody see where right here where I am? Okay.
And this, the way?
No.
I've been working on this for, this is the fifth year, and twice this has almost killed me doing this. So I'm putting out as much as I can for you. I've been motivated by my time with Marion to become more artistic as time goes on. And this is my one time a year that it comes out of me and I just
he has to do it.
It just has to come out of me. That's all, and I don't know how I can tell it any more than I don't like that red with this. I'm gonna use green instead. And I'm kind of a left brain guy, so I like to have balance, and so I got the red going.
Gotta have a straight line.
Well, there's that. That pretty much goes without saying.
Yeah.
And you know, what I'm trying to get to here is man's inhumanity to man. And is anybody seeing that with me? it's like too busy the way. I don't know what. Mary, can you help me? I'm
sure. What would you like?
I need you to hold that.
Okay.
And I thought I was going to like it better with that way, but I really don't. So,
okay, so you want to put this?
I'm going to put it back on there.
This way?
The way it came off.
Okay.
But not perfect. It's got to be offset.
It's got to be offset.
Perfect. Just See. Okay.
You're sticking, okay.
That, oh, okay.
Perfect.
Beautiful.
Almost.
Now, I'm proud enough of this that what I want to do is put it upstairs in the Holden safe. And 10 years from now, when we all come back for the Elder Hostel 2016, we'll go up to the safe and we'll pull it out of the safe and we'll bring it back down here and I'll put it in an envelope and I'll bring it back out and we'll think, man, that's pretty crappy, huh? But somebody will say, well, now, Don, how did you do that? Because we might want to do it too. And I said, well, the first thing I did was I had the red line with the marker and then I put the green tape on top of it. And then I cut the bottom off of it, and then I kind of taped it back on. You guys will go, wait a minute, that was 10 years ago. How do you remember that? It's like magic. And I'll say, no, it's the law of cross-cutting relationships. I'm a geologist.
Bad.
The point is, younger events cut older events. Hopefully everybody will get past the pandemonium and stupidness onto the point here. What's the oldest event here? The oldest event is drawing the red line.
Yeah, right.
The red line is cut by everything. It's cut by the green line. Hopefully you can see that this green overlays the red. And it's also cut by the cutting, which I did, which was the last thing I did. The green tape cuts is the second thing in the order that I did them. So it doesn't get cut by the red line, it cuts it, but it does get cut by the scissor cut, because the scissor cut came later. Make sense?
All right, now what?
Now what? We take this same idea and we move it to the geologic realm.
Oh, this is a leap of faith.
It's a... So that we look, and this is in your packet. We lay down three beds in this block diagram. Bed one, which is a white bed, two, which is a black bed, and three, which is kind of a gray bed. And then a fault happens. Law of original horizontality says they get laid down flat. Law of superposition says the oldest one's on the bottom. Law of cross-cutting relationships says the way that since this fault cuts all three beds, one, two, and three, the fault must have happened after beds one, two, and three were laid down. Make sense?
Yeah.
We're into this idea of relative age dating now, which says we can't tell, is this bed a billion years old or yesterday? Don't know. Is this bed older or younger than this bed? It's older. We assume that it's all flat or it's all right side up. Therefore, this is the oldest thing, the next oldest thing, the third oldest thing, and the most recent thing. Make sense? If we go to the right-hand block diagram, now for some reason more sedimentation has occurred on top of this faulted area, and bed number four has been laid down. Is bed number four cut by the fault? No. Is bed number four younger than the fault?
Yes.
So now when we go back to our geologic map and our ideas of how the geology of this place came about, where we can find these cross-cutting relationships or where we can find the beds being laid down and find them right side up, we can start ordering events. Again, we don't know anything about the real age. Did this happen a billion years ago or a million years ago? This could have happened a billion years ago, and this could have happened last week. We can't tell that, but we can tell that this is a younger, a more recent event than this. We can tell that the fault is more recent than any of those beds, but we can tell that the fault is older than bed number four because it doesn't cut it. Make sense? And all of geology from there on is simply more complicated versions of this very, these very simple concepts and these very simple rules. If we find beds, we assume they were originally laid down flat. If they're in place, we assume the oldest stuff is on the bottom. And if something cuts something, it's younger than the thing that it cut. And now we're doing a Sudoku puzzle. And we know the three rules of Sudoku, which are each box has to have each of the nine numbers, and each column has to have each of the nine numbers, and each of the, and now we're just using those same bloody rules time after time after time to come up with a more complicated story. So these, that's why I think these are sort of the basic rules of geology that help us order events. And then if we're going to try to figure out precise ages, now we can use the the fossils that might be in one of these beds, or we can radiometrically date the granite that we had a piece of yesterday. We can take some of the minerals out of there and date that. And it may be in let's stay with our simple picture, it may be that we can find an age date for a clam in bed number one and a snail in bed number three, and we can put sort of bounds on things. But we still don't know precisely what the age dates are. So we build this up the best we can. Our age dates still need to keep in conformance with whether we know something is older or younger. But we hope that the relative places we put each of the events in still holds once we get the dates to them. Otherwise, we've got to go back and rethink our original hypotheses. So all geology from then on out is just more complicated versions and more gray area stuff of these basic concepts. What time do we have? We have 10 more minutes. Let's look at some slides. How about that? We'll save some geology for another time, but we'll look at a few slides and I'll tell you all the rest of the geology I know. This is a big rock that I came across in Indonesia when I was there doing some hiking one time. And the point of this that I, when we looked at rocks like this yesterday in our quiz, how many different rock types are present? Is it angular or rounded or sub-rounded? What can we tell about the energy of the environment and deposition? Big fragments in here, some rounded, some angular, all different kinds of things. I've got the actual photo of this that doesn't translate very well here. Here's more rocks down here, a big red piece right in here. This, I assume, is a volcanic flow that came off a volcano in Indonesia and just blasted everything in its wake and picked it up and chundered it up and spun it up into this rock type, because that's what happens in Indonesia when you have that style of volcanism of volcanoes is much more Mount St. Helens-ish than it is Hawaii-ish. It's real energetic. The magma is real viscous. It's real gooey. And so it takes, when it blows, it blows. It's not this runny stuff like you get in Hawaii. It's Mount St. Helens. If we wanted to, if we were really serious about this, we could try to trace, if we could find the rest of the geology of that area, we could try to find the path that this volcanic flow took by looking back at the rocks that are included in it, right? This stuff, it flowed across some place where this was the rock at the surface, and it picked it up and incorporated it. So we could look, and we could try to find on our geologic map. We say, here's the five different kind of rocks that we have in our volcanic flow. Where are those five kind of rocks right next to each other? And we might be able to trace that path back. So high energy, angular fragments predominantly. It's harder to tell in this than it is in the regular photo.
Question.
Yes.
thinking how you're saying this happened, or when you have a glacier.